Hey everybody, welcome back to the Render Bar. My name is Steve Jax.
I'm Richard Sanchez.
And we want to say thank you for joining us again on another episode. This time we're recording over at my place in Sherman Oaks. How are you doing, Rich?
I can't complain, you know. Yeah. 2025 has shaped out to be a pretty crazy year, both work-wise and certainly socially, politically. But, you know, that's another topic for another podcast.
Yeah, right. I know. We're not the political podcast.
Not us.
We are the Render Bar podcast, all things VFX editing related and industry related. I got some feedback here. We have a YouTube channel, Render Bar Podcast on YouTube. We got a comment, which is awesome. And we all want everybody to be commenting and liking our recordings and everything because we love the feedback. We got at Zenith Media on YouTube saying, "This is a great show. I have a BA in digital film and have been working primarily in live events for the past few years. My wife and I moved to California last year for a job that took me away from being able to work on gigs outside of my day job. Trying to network a bit, but no opportunities have solidified so that I can quit and try to work closer to home. Any suggestions on networking in the current environment? I want to help make entertainment again, not content." I remember that. That's one of the things we were talking about last week.
Oh, yeah. Entertainment is both good. Well, yeah. I mean, I think to answer the question as to how to network, you know, it's funny. I came to the revelation about networking a few years ago, and I wish I would have learned it earlier in my career, because networking to me was always kind of an icky word. It always felt a little self-serving. It also felt a little bit like that film The Player with Tim Robbins playing mm-hmm. the studio executive, and everybody, these power players, are just sort of arrogantly networking at their parties, and it always made me feel self-conscious. And a few years ago I realized that really all networking is being a friend. And I think once you distill it down to that and treat it that way, and part of being a friend is not being transactional, but just being genuine, just taking an interest in people, and especially acknowledging that some people want to talk about film and some people really don't, but we're all part of this community. And I think approaching it without expectation, because I've always found I can always tell when people are sniffing around for a job, they're just only talking to me hoping to get a job. And I also recognize the times that I've done the same to others. Yes. And I thought I was being sly and getting away with it. And boy, was I not.
Yes. I have had experience sending out all those cold emails, and, you know, even to people I've already met in person, but mm-hmm. I remember feeling the only relationship I had with that person mm-hmm. was saying, "Hey, I'm available to work."
Yeah.
You know, and realizing that there wasn't anything else there.
Yeah.
And one thing I'll say is that, and I'm sure you might agree, is that it is more than just saying, "Hey, I'm available to work." It's cultivating some kind of, like, communication relationship.
Yeah.
Even if you don't know the person, it's more than just letting them know you're free. It's, "Hey, can I pick your brain on a thing? Mm-hmm. Hey, can I take you out for a coffee? Hey, would you like to chat about, you know, the industry or something? I'm looking to meet some more people and I love the work you do." Because that stuff goes such a long way than mm-hmm. just saying, "Hey, I'm free."
Yeah, and again, saying, "Hey, I'm free," just always seems to carry the baggage of, "I'm looking for something from you." And I've always felt like, by nature of us being in the same field, and certainly as an assistant editor to an editor, if an assistant editor reaches out to an editor, if they're getting along well, the question of could we or should we work together will generally naturally occur.
Oh, yeah.
And you'll find that over time, if the situation turns into a, "I really enjoy this person," it's probably going to naturally establish itself. But when you kind of show up and go, "Hey, can I get a job out of you?" You know, people smell it a mile away.
100%. This reminds me of a mixer I went to back in New York City, maybe 2015, 16, 17, somewhere around there.
Yeah.
I felt like I still didn't have, like, my thing, my niche to feel solidified in the industry. I was working on stuff.
Felt like an outsider?
Not so much outsider in the mixer world.
Okay.
Like going to mixers and being social. There's mm-hmm. a difference between, like, I work and have a resume.
Yeah.
Versus I feel like I am in the mix in the social scene of, like, I know a lot of people and I can hobnob and I can chit chat easily.
Yeah.
I feel like I did not have that. So it was a Cinco de Mayo mixer, and I remember going, because you go, you know, you're young and you go to all the mixers. And I know people out here that I've met, they're young and they say the same thing. I go to the mixer. You got to go to the mixer. And I would go and I feel like, you know, I might know some people, but not well enough to hold a casual conversation. So then you try, but then you're just like feeling like I'm... And the other part of this story is that I was not working.
Okay.
I was out of work for about 3 months. So I'm there at this mixer. Really, I'm here to get a job.
Sure.
Why do you go to a mixer if you're not working? It's because maybe you want to meet somebody that might say, I need somebody. Start Monday. And you're like, that's me. But in reality, that really tarnished that evening for me. Because I went thinking I'm going to maybe meet somebody. And this is almost sounds like dating. Because in a way it is, right?
I mean, yeah.
It is. Like, I went to this mixer thinking, I am stressed because I'm not working. And I got to go make an appearance. So I feel like I had to go.
You need to be seen.
Yes. So I go and I realize all I'm doing is like asking people if they need help. And I'm asking, for something. I want something. And so I learned. And then what happened that night is that I got kind of overwhelmed from being there. And I'm feeling like I didn't belong here because I didn't have that much, that deep of a rapport with many people. And so I had maybe like a mini panic attack because I feel like I don't feel comfortable here.
I know that
and
feeling
I just
well.
Got to get out. So I left early. I left. I like kind of peaced out.
Felt dejected.
Just kind of like. I didn't, like, now I go to these things and I feel good because I know enough people, I know people to just say, hey, what's up? And it has nothing to do with getting a job. It's about seeing people that you haven't seen in a while and you're catching up. And so I learned from that after, like, dipping out and feeling like a piece of crap, feeling like a failure, feeling like I'm not good at what I do, even though none of that's true. It's just more like this little section of socializing, maybe I needed some work on. And I think I maybe talked to my wife about it afterward, and she said something great to me, which was like, if you go looking for something, you're not going to get anything. But if you go saying, I have something that you may need, and you're there to fulfill someone else's needs, like you're offering something, suddenly it changed the whole mindset. Because now I go to things not thinking I'm going to get anything out of it, but what can I offer to somebody else? You know, so that's really helped a lot by changing that mindset.
Well, and also if you go into these events and the objective is to get a job or a job offer, that's kind of something that that's like two or three steps into a relationship. And it's something that while it is possible within the event of a mixer, it's just unlikely. But a more reasonable expectation is I go there to meet someone interesting. That's something that's easily attainable, and that is the first step. And if, you know, if they just happen to go, oh my gosh, I need someone who does what you do. Are you available? If that stroke of luck happens, and I know people who that's happened to, good for you. But what's more likely to happen is you meet a cool person, and you reach out to them, you chit-chat, you get coffee, and then over time, hey, you know, I think there's something to be said of if you make a friend – that's a success. And I think, you know, even within you've been in this field a long time, as have I, and I think I also fall into those same patterns at a lot of these mixer events where I spend most of my time catching up with old friends, which is great. And I think if you want to inject a little quote-unquote business to this, the one thing I do try to do at these mixer events is I do try to make an effort at least one time in the evening to find somebody just who looks interesting, catches your eye, and just walk up to a stranger and go, hey, how you doing? I'm Richard. It's nice to meet you. And invariably, you know, oh, I'm so-and-so. And you just meet someone and hey, great, they're a cool person, and you just kind of keep in touch. And with the guild, you know, with the guild membership directory, you can find people's email addresses, you can say what's up. But, you know, the other thing, I've been doing this lately, and it's kind of been something that I've been liking, the idea of building community, is when I watch a show and I love it, what I'll do is I will either go to the Editors Guild member directory, or if you have IMDb Pro or LinkedIn, I'll try to find those people online. And again, approaching it without an expectation. I'm not trying to get a job out of it, but everyone likes a compliment. And if I see like an episode of television or a movie that I just love, I'll just go, hey, that was great. And I mean, I always try to have something thoughtful to say, not just that was great. That's kind of a nothing conversation. And I think there's something cool to be said of. Maybe that leads to a friendship, which might lead to a working relationship. But if nothing else, you know, maybe I get the satisfaction of making someone feel good for a little while. And I'm, it's kind of cool to reach out to people in your community who you respect.
Yeah.
And that in and of itself is kind of a success.
For sure. For sure. I like the idea of when you saying go, when you're at a mixer, just being able to feel comfortable enough going up to somebody and saying, hey, my name's Steve. What do you do?
Yeah.
Yeah. Cause you know that you're there to meet people.
Yeah.
And it isn't about feeling uncomfortable that you're trying to get a job out of this. So this is like for all the people out there listening who aren't working right now.
Yeah.
And you go to a mixer or you're coming, meeting somebody who is working. It try maybe to less expect a job from anybody,
mm-hmm.
but more of how can you, what do you have to offer that person?
Yeah.
And that may not even be skills at the Avid. It could be FileMaker or doing VFX editing, but maybe it's skills at, I am a great listener, or I offer great feedback for this person because they're stressed about something, or they love baseball and I love baseball and we have baseball to talk about. Mm-hmm. People love to talk about the things they love to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
They want to be able to work with somebody that they get along with, and mm-hmm. You can work with somebody who is the smartest person in the room, but they can't chit chat with you and you don't have zero shared interests. It might not go as far.
Yeah.
You know? Because in the end of the day, you want to hire people that you like to be around.
Yeah.
You know, it's always been the case. Who do I mind sitting next to for 12 hours a day, 5 days a week?
Yeah.
Who do you mind hanging out with more than your family? That's the sad part.
I mean, yeah. And also when, you know, when you're stuck in an office for 14 hours, who's someone that is going to potentially keep you upbeat? It's like,
yeah.
Well, I'm pissed off that I have to be here so late. Well, this person keeps me in a good mood. So,
yep.
Okay. That there's a lot of value in that.
Yeah, for sure. Especially if you're trying to make a name for yourself, like be a guy or girl who everybody wants to be around. And I tell this to young people, because it's something I learned when I first had a PA.
Mm-hmm.
So I was an assistant editor, and the first time I had a PA under me, mm-hmm. and I suddenly had to tell them what to do and keep track of them.
Yeah.
And I didn't know how to do this. I was like, I don't know. I'm always the bottom of the barrel in the editing room.
Yeah.
So one of my brothers is a principal for elementary schools. It talks a lot about leadership and leadership skills and how to be, you know, a leader of a group of people. And it is more about being a boss and it is about being a leader and getting people excited to do their job.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of an aside. But what I took from that was, how do I teach a PA how to be excited to do their job and lead by example rather than just telling them what to do?
Yeah.
So what I say to young people who are trying to make a name, make their way, I kind of give them that same thing, but like, see what you can do to give off any leadership skills.
Yeah.
You may not be in charge of anybody, but I know as a PA, as like for the folks there, they're just starting as a PA, for mm-hmm. example, that are, you know, getting lunch for everyone and feel like this job sucks. All I do is get lunch and run errands. The thing that feels like a leadership skill would be, I'm great at gathering people around for lunch and having great conversation. And I bring some levity in the middle of their day.
Yeah.
You know, or I schedule meetups on the weekends.
Yeah.
Every once a month for my crew.
Yeah.
And I get them excited and maybe I bring them, you know, when I get the coffee, I bring a little extra, I don't know, something. But that idea of like you're infusing you're imbuing or embodying a level of personality that others want to be around or want to
very much so
copy, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, and I think there's sort of a trapping that a lot of people fall into sometimes. And it, to your point about being the person who they want around, one quality that most people find fairly trying are the people who like to present themselves as always being the smartest person in the room in every circumstance. I'm smarter than everybody or I'm better than this. And on one hand, you want someone who is confident and knows their skills and knows and that's a wonderful thing. But I have found I'm generally more excited to have someone who's goofy and fun than, you know, like, I'm so good, I'm so smart. I was like, well, cool. You know, I grow tired of that.
Yeah, like, quickly. Yeah, you win.
Yeah.
Good for you.
Yeah.
Now what?
Yeah.
You know? Yeah, I hear you.
And you see it in a variety of different levels, either in terms of like, you know, well, I know how to do that in the Avatar, or I know how to do this, and that's cool. The other thing I often find too, I think it's a common thing that I personally find off-putting, is when people who are new to the field, I think there is this idea that by bad-mouthing every film you see, you're portraying yourself as being smart and discerning. And for me, at a certain point, I'm just like, do you like anything? Because all I hear is what you don't like, and you trash these big filmmakers that have big names and, you know, and have done a lot of films. And I don't like every film, nor do I like every filmmaker, and that's fine. But at the same time, also, when every conversation is this film sucks or this filmmaker is a hack, I just go, I get a little tired of that.
Totally. I hear you. Thanks, Zenith Media, for your comment on our YouTube page. That led to a really great conversation about some great topics here. But what you were just chatting about, Richard, actually relates to something else that was coming up this week with the Oscars and Sean Baker's win for Best Editing at the
Congratulations,
Oscars.
Sean.
Congratulations.
Quadruple Oscar.
Wonderful film. And he seemed like he was really ecstatic and happy to win that award, going up to the stage four times. That's all amazing.
Mm-hmm.
But I know, and we both have seen on some of the message boards, a lot of feedback about his win. And maybe not some nice words.
Yeah, the first thing that I saw was, and it came out of one of the Facebook groups where there was a graphic. And that was the first thing that made me a little suspicious, is it was a screen grab of a post from somewhere else, probably Reddit, where somebody was complaining about pay rates on the film, and they were criticizing Sean about the film and when they tried to go union. And that is something that as a very staunch union man, that's something that I'm sensitive to, while also acknowledging the budget of the film. And then over time, there was some other voices who came up. And of course, it's always difficult online because you don't really know who these people are speaking up on the internet all the time. I would like to believe that they have no reason to lie, but it's hard to trust what you see, especially on social media. And then I saw some conflicting voices that said, we were treated well, we went in with the intention of flipping, we did flip, we got our back pay. And even within the context of our own union Facebook group, I'm not going to disclose what was said because that would violate the confidentiality of our union Facebook group, but someone spoke up who also had firsthand knowledge. And I think I would urge people to be careful how they get carried away with what they hear online, because first of all, I mean, one of the biggest criticisms was that he had mentioned that there was only three people allowed in his cutting room, which was himself, his wife, and his dog. And I know people took that very personally, particularly people felt that his assistant editor wasn't allowed in. And the first point I would make is that it was clearly a joke, and maybe it wasn't the funniest joke you've ever heard, but it really, I think it was far more innocuous than it was made out to be. And the other thing I think back to is, I think back to 2016. I remember at the time, Margaret Sixel was nominated for Best Editing for Mad Max Fury Road. And at the same time, somebody via Reddit came on and started bad-mouthing her and saying that maybe she wasn't the leader that she presented herself as, and that she didn't do as much work. And people really ran with it, and people were, oh, she's full of it. And it's one of those things too, where again, I saw this and I was like, I'm not really prepared to believe that, you know, I can't just take a Reddit thread. And at a certain point, then someone on that Reddit thread who identified themselves said, this is not true. And I applaud this person for doing that, because there's a variety of dynamics that go on in a cutting room, and it's not always, we always struggle sometimes with personalities and sometimes with perceptions. And I don't know, I would urge people when they see these things to take it with a grain of salt. And also, we're passionate about what we do. And I'm also passionate about the idea that this is a job and we should be compensated fairly. But I also recognize that there's a variety of films. There are $100 million films, and you should get your fair share of that chunk. And if you're working on a $6 million or less film, there's also, there should be an acknowledgement of what we are in for, compensation-wise. And it's simply, that's just what you're in for with that. And also, every cutting room is run a little differently, and Sean cuts his own films, and that's always a different dynamic, especially an indie filmmaker working on their own. And, you know, I'll say this. As far as filmmakers and managers of people who work for them in this field, there is a world of abuse that is overlooked and of awful people who are tolerated because they make people money. But I will just say this as a personal friend of Mr. Baker, because I've worked with him. He is not one. He is a wonderful person. And that was, I had a personal connection. So, of course, that was one thing driving me. But I would urge people to not fall into mob mentality. Because also, if the criticism is that he didn't thank his assistant editor, and I wish every editor accepting an award thanked their entire post team, this is not unique to him at all. And I think if every assistant editor stood up and every assistant editor who was not thanked in a speech, who was not invited to a premiere, and I don't think it is always as devious as it's easy to think it is. I think sometimes you just, it just slips the mind in the moment. It just, I'm sorry that I didn't think of you. I've personally had situations where I didn't even know there were premiere events for shows that I worked on.
Oh, yeah.
And then via social media, I saw that certain members of the crew were at this premiere event. And I'll admit, that hurt.
Yeah.
I was upset by that. I think that should change. But again, it's totally unfair to make him the pariah for this larger issue.
Well said, 100%. I mean, if you do that, then you got to do that for every other winner up on that stage that night.
Yeah.
And then to further that point, it's like, how much are we really weighing that worth of that award too? You know, I mean, it is the Oscars, and it's the achievement of the year and of a lifetime for many, many people in the industry. You can kind of see it as a, how are we even looking at the Oscars anymore? And is it worth it to start a, you know, message board tantrum with each other about who said what, or not, it wasn't enough thanks, or could have been more, or it was too much, or whatever. Every show's different. Every person's different. And when you're in that situation, it's about you. Like, if you won the award, it's about you. And yes, you want to thank as many people as possible.
Yeah.
But you also know, as we see, half these people are getting played off on stage.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So you only have so much time. And yes, he won 4 awards, and maybe he was up there 4 times and could have had time to think about it and thank some more people. But, like, I don't know. You know how these things go.
I also would like, I also think too, I don't necessarily know that he assumed he was going to win 4 Oscars, or he would have had 4 pieces of paper with 4 prepared speeches. So you know what? I'm really going to offer a benefit of the doubt that said, if you had a piece of paper with every winning speech because you expected to win 4 times, that would be what would guide you to make sure you're thanking everybody that should be thanked and saying everything appropriately as you didn't. But at a certain point, you go up there and go, I want to thank this end.
You know, you're caught up in the moment.
Yeah.
But I would say, how cool is it to say that you know, just this idea, I was thinking about this, wrote, directed, edited, and produced his own film and won all those awards?
That's...
like, wow.
That's huge.
Think about anything you've made personally.
Yeah.
And to think that everybody loved it so much, they said, you're the best.
And again, what I come back to as well is, for a quadruple Oscar winner, it could not have happened to a nicer person. and I'm over the moon happy for him.
Cool, cool. We are too. I think that's a great, seeing his face each time he won an award. The joke was that the smile on his face is so big each time. I thought it was cool. You know, would I say it's my favorite film of the year? Maybe not, but I think that a lot of other people did, and
you know what though,
and that could be what some of the feedback is, the backlash on the message boards, is that maybe people didn't think it was the best of that year, and or not, and maybe that's why they're commenting in that way, because you aren't hearing it from other departments. Well, maybe this is an editing message board, but still, you're hearing it more focused on that.
But I hope it leads to people checking out his earlier films. I was listening to a interview on NPR with him this week, and he was talking about two films that he worked on, Prince of Broadway and Starlet. And both of those films are remarkable, especially Starlet. And I would urge anybody who's a fan of his films, if you haven't seen those, check them out. I just loved Starlet. It's this wonderful moral dilemma. Stars Dree Hemingway, and I loved it. It's just fantastic.
Cool, I'll have to check that one out. Yeah. I did love that as his speech for Best Director, or was it producer? I don't know. Maybe it was one of his last speeches I think he had to do. Making a statement about movie theaters, bringing movie theaters back. Mm-hmm. Not that they've gone away, but some did. You know, during the pandemic, a lot of theaters couldn't afford the rent. And it's a shame that Hollywood as an industry didn't find some way to continue to keep, especially out here in LA, where we have the Arclight Theater, that all of them just disappeared.
That broke my heart.
Like, one of the nicest theaters I've ever been to.
Yeah.
And Hollywood can't even find a way to make sure that these theaters are kept during that time of the pandemic. That's really sad to me. And I think what he said was really important, to find a way that the studios need to find a way to keep movie theaters running.
Yeah.
I don't know what that means. There's so many people. Everyone has their own ideas of how that could be. And I think certainly we don't want to go back to the studio system where, you know, Paramount was owning a theater and only ran Paramount movies. But you could argue that maybe that's what we need. I don't know. What do you think about that? I mean, I think that was really important for him to say it on a platform like that, because so many theaters are shutting down all the time.
Yeah.
And movie tickets are so expensive. Refreshments are so expensive. Everyone is complaining about how pricey it is to go out to the movies.
Yeah.
And I just saw this over the weekend, or maybe it was last week. Bridget Jones there's like the fourth sequel in the Bridget Jones Diary movies that came out in the U.S. direct to Peacock, I think, and worldwide, it's in theaters.
Oh.
So in the UK, it's in theaters. In Australia, it's in theaters. Everywhere else, it's in theaters. And it made like over $100 million its opening weekend.
Yeah.
So what was the decision there?
Yeah.
So there's a lot of things that are going on there, I think, that would love to see remedied. And, you know, the economy, the way it is, the way the world is right now, things are just always morphing and changing.
Yeah.
But, you know, I love that he had the right mind to speak up about it in that moment.
Yeah.
When there's so much of politics you could talk about. That's the thing that's... Why are the Oscars having this award ceremony in the first place?
Yeah.
Why did it start? To get people interested in movies again.
Let's celebrate film.
Celebrate film. So why are we only celebrating the films that most majority of people watching this award show at home have not seen?
Yeah.
You know, Anora being one of them.
Yeah. I mean, you know, to your point, you know, going back to the Paramount Decree, I mean, one, the Paramount Decree did expire, I believe, in 2020. But I mean, it's interesting because effectively that's what streaming networks are anyway. A studio that owns its distribution in the form of a streamer, it's basically the same thing. Mm-hmm. So
that's a great point.
And there is something to be said about, I mean, yes, the vertical integration created a monopoly and that's what they broke up, but it would absolutely break my heart to see the theatrical experience continue to recede, and it most certainly still is. I appreciate that that Quentin Tarantino is preserving the Vista Theater, and that there are some people making a stand to try to keep that alive. But yeah, it's in a tough place.
Mm-hmm.
And back to just the general state of the industry, I mean, I think that's kind of where we are with theaters, the general state of an industry. I mean, we're still, it's 2025, and we'd all heard Survive Till 25. Here we are. I mean, we are rounding out the end of the first quarter of 2025. Mm-hmm. What's your experience been like? What have you heard? What have you experienced?
I've heard, actually this week, starting to hear people with multiple interviews.
Okay.
I have a friend that went on like 4 different interviews last week.
That's great.
So people are looking for employees.
Yeah.
Somewhere. And I think that's a great thing that's happening. And it's a great notion that people are getting interviews and maybe things are on the rise.
Yeah, it's reason to be optimistic.
Yeah, for sure.
Likewise, I had an interview myself, which is, it's only one interview. I definitely feel like we are not where we were in 2021, but we can acknowledge that 2021 was the height of the bubble just before it burst. But I think if we can get to a place closer to 2018 or so, that would be something valuable. We're not there yet, but projects are ramping up. It's still slow. I wouldn't be so cynical to say, because I've already heard people saying exist until 26. That's simply unfeasible.
Yeah.
We have been starting with the strikes, and I want to be very clear in saying I do not blame the strikes for this. The strikes affected this, and I think the strikes presented a convenient excuse for people to blame, but the strikes are not solely responsible for what we're dealing with. I think most of this is a market correction.
Yeah.
There was, the streamers came out, they needed to fill them with material, hence the rise of the term content. No one likes that term, but they rushed to fill it with entertainment, and it was simply unsustainable. And so here we are. We are in a state of correction. It will get better, but it's going to be slow for a while. I still think what was surprising to me is that reality television has not been as prevalent as it was in 2008 during that strike. But what's interesting is we've seen new things, new platforms coming out. Petra Caliguri, who he's been posting these great videos via LinkedIn and Instagram. I'm sure most of you have seen them. He is a reality producer, and he's been touting this new platform about equity sharing for artists. I mean, it's effectively like a new era United Artists, and I think it's a great thing to see these new platforms rising out of this sense of, okay, if the studio system as it was is no longer there, we're going to figure out a new process of financing film. It's called Share Platform. It's a site that you can sign up for, and it puts artists in contact with each other, and the idea is they will come together and can help crowdfund projects and share in the equity in them. And that's an exciting thing.
That's great.
It's a new...
Yeah, it seems like there's got to be a way to... I mean, it seems like the studio system is... Is it becoming old-fashioned in a way? Is it like the choices that are being made don't seem... even this weekend... Mickey 17 came out this weekend, and I'm already reading that on a $110 million budget, it's only going to maybe bring in $20 million this weekend.
My gosh.
So this is a trend that we're seeing, that movies are they're spending a lot of money on movies for very little return.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, somebody at the top would have to think, hey, I think we're doing it wrong. How do we course correct?
Yeah.
Because we're seeing the course correction in streaming saying, hang on, maybe we shouldn't be making so many shows.
Yeah.
Maybe we need to curb it a bit because we're not seeing it as economically viable to us as we thought it was going to be.
Yeah.
Because all we do is get subscribers. We're not getting price per film or show.
Yeah.
Rental or purchase. It's monthly memberships. That's it. Now, that is a lot per user, but think about the number of people who would watch that one show at one time or one movie at one time.
Yeah.
Might be a lot different. So then you do see that there is a limit to how much we can make that is worth our time and money.
Yeah.
For return. And so you think even with the studio system that maybe it's not worth to be spending over $100 million on small, what feels like small movies?
I mean, looking at the success of Anora, I think maybe that serves as a good example too of maybe there's a time, and I'm saying this from the standpoint of a visual effects editor, my bread and butter are big visual effects films, but maybe there's something to be said about pumping the brakes a little bit on high fantasy films, your sci-fis, your, you know, these big spectacle films, and going back to something that is more about people in the sense of that's what Anora is, you know. Or I think back to when I really fell in love with film, and the one film that really stuck out in my mind was Swingers, you mm-hmm. know, just a film about people being people, you know, and you didn't really need a lot to do that. I mean, at the time, without everybody having an iPhone in their pocket that they could shoot a film on, they had to go and shoot that on 16mm. I mean, there was challenges, but a lot of those challenges are not quite the same as they were nowadays. And so there is something to be said about making sure the story is strong and making films about people, that there are things that can be done more simply.
Yeah, you're right. I think that's what we kind of used to have. Mm-hmm. And I think that would be, that's you see that on television.
Yeah.
We're watching the show called Paradise on Hulu right now. It's really great. And there's a sci-fi element to it. But this is the kind of TV that I enjoy where, yes, there's a science fiction element to it.
Yeah.
But they didn't throw so much money at it that it feels like you're watching a spectacle each week.
Yeah.
It is less about the vision. Maybe that's a spoiler to anyone who hasn't seen this Paradise yet. Anyway,
spoiler alert.
Sorry, there's some science fiction aspect to it, but not terribly much. And it's a show that doesn't look like they spent tons of money on. They spent money on it.
But yeah.
Versus something like Silo that we're also watching on Apple TV, where it looks expensive.
Okay.
You can see where the money went. And in the visual effects and in the set design. And then something like Paradise, not as much. It feels more like something you might find on NBC.
Mm-hmm.
And I know the same creators wrote and created This Is Us. So it does come from television people. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's why I dig it. It feels like television, like week to week. Yeah. It's about character. It's about the story, emotional drama, and arcs of characters, not so much the plot.
Yeah.
And what we see a lot with streaming is plot driven.
Yeah.
You know, spectacle.
Yeah.
So even on the small screen, you're seeing big things.
Yeah.
But we're not getting that in the theater. Well, you're getting spectacle in the theater, but we're also getting spectacle on TV.
Mm.
But why is it that the spectacle on TV sometimes is garnering more attention than the ones in the theater? So more people will likely talk about Severance than they would whatever movie's out right now.
Yeah.
You know, culturally, I would say. Culturally, people may be talking more about their favorite television show than they are about their favorite movie right now.
Yeah.
And that's something that I think studios could be learning a lesson from, that how do we get people talking about the movies and not TV?
Yeah.
And not to say that they should. It's not an extreme one or the other. It is both. But it is more so, we're losing people in the theater.
Yeah.
I mean, movies are still making money, but we're not seeing the cultural relevance anymore. Look at the Oscars. Of all the movies that were big hits financially,
mm-hmm.
Wicked only won a couple awards.
That's true.
Dune won only some technical awards.
That's right.
And you could even argue, in my opinion, I thought Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes deserved the VFX Oscar
mm-hmm.
for their work on the ape simulation and the water simulation.
Yeah.
But Dune, more people probably saw it.
Mm-hmm.
More people were just aware of Dune because Dune was a bigger film. It was a sequel of a more recent film.
Sure.
I don't know, but people maybe were just, the voters were maybe more aware of that one than they were Planet of the Apes. And they vote for it. But, you know, in the top 10 of the films, most of them were small, tiny movies.
Yeah.
And we're saying that's what the voters want to see.
It's funny, the years felt so long too, that Dune 2 feels so far away.
It does.
Yeah.
Well, because it came out, what, a year ago? March of last year?
Yeah.
Probably.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's another reason why it feels like it's not in this classification.
Yeah.
But to me, you know, a movie like Wicked, a lot of special effects, great performances, great music. It kind of felt to me like it hit all four quadrants. Like anybody can walk in this movie and enjoy it.
Yeah.
You know, I guess if you hate musicals, maybe, but, you know, movies, I think what you're kind of was getting to is that movies like Anora, where it is more character driven,
mm-hmm.
and movies that can kind of focus on that, that all people can relate to. But maybe it's because we're still in a time of we're not happy with where the world is going.
Yeah.
So we just keep making spectacle.
But, you know, I will say, though, on that note, I mean, speaking of spectacle, Wicked is, whether you don't like musicals or not, Wicked was pretty darn impressive. Right. I am a big fan of John M. Chu's work. I think the musicals he's done with, I was a huge fan of In the Heights and Wicked.
So good.
You know, I remember seeing the commercials for Wicked and I knew what the story was about, but nothing, when I would see advertisements for the Wicked's performing at some local stage, I just wasn't falling over myself to want to see it. But that end sequence between Ariana Grande and Cynthia Erivo, it was remarkable.
If, oh my God.
If only for that sequence alone, but there's the library sequence and the ending sequence. Those two sequences are triumphs.
Have you seen the stage musical?
I actually have not.
Neither have I.
Mm-hmm.
So all I know is from listening to the musical soundtrack. Mm-hmm. So I'm aware of the songs and I was aware of kind of generally the plot,
mm-hmm.
but seeing the film version, mm-hmm. especially seeing the Defying Gravity song performance at mm-hmm. the end, what I was just shocked at is how much they like found a way to extend that song.
Yes.
And not just be, because it's the end of Act One.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the grand finale.
Yeah.
But they found a way to milk that song.
Oh, yeah.
Into an entire climactic set piece.
Yes.
Where you didn't even know, you've kind of forgot that the song hadn't finished yet.
Yes.
And then suddenly they get back into it and you're like, oh.
And we're still.
It his John Chu's films do that to me. And it was a bummer to me that ended up didn't winning. Same with Complete Unknown, because in Complete yeah. Unknown, I mean, maybe it's easier because you have the music of Bob Dylan.
Yeah.
It's set to the backdrop of the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's just rich with storytelling that everyone can kind of like relate to. You can pull the heartstrings because it's yeah. just a time ridden with angst and cultural change, and a lot happened.
Yeah.
That it's easy to kind of feel like, oh, that moved me. But it moved me.
Yeah.
And maybe I'm not as elevated as others as a moviegoer.
Yeah.
But it hits me, you know? Yeah. That's why I go to the movies. I want to feel something. And I think that some of these smaller films, while great, while Anora was really, really wonderful, I thought Mikey Madison did a fantastic performance.
Yeah.
There were moments where I'm like, you know, I like it. It's good. Didn't love the ending, but, you know,
yeah.
I wouldn't say it's terrible by any means.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
It's wonderful, but, and for being a small indie film, and that's one thing to go back to Sean Baker's speech, his speech he was talking about, or just generally, he's always been a indie film lifer.
Mm-hmm.
And I respect that. Someone that is like, I'm going to make small movies and not try to make the big thing. You know, because there's a lot to be said with the restriction
mm-hmm.
in which and how you make your film.
Yeah.
And if any of these big movies can just say, hey, what if we made the same movie, but with like half the budget?
Mm-hmm.
How do we still tell the same story creatively?
Yeah.
And a lot of times you hear that and you'll say, well, there's no way.
Yeah.
It's impossible. And maybe certain movies it is. But maybe you tell the different version of that story.
Yeah. You find a way.
You find a way.
Yeah.
Just like Jeff Goldblum said.
That's exactly what I was thinking.
Life finds a way.
But, you know, on the note of spectacle, though, VFX editor, we talked a little bit about this last episode about the VFX editor designation. That's one that's kind of come to the forefront, too, in terms of we've gotten requirements on how to get that designation applied. I don't know if have you gotten your paperwork in with the contract services to do that?
No, I haven't.
You know, it's interesting because we got an email from the Guild, and part of that is in order to avoid an upgrade fee from assistant editor to VFX editor, you need to change your designation by June 30th.
Mm.
And so that's for anybody who is currently working as a VFX editor. If you are classified as a Z1 editor, You don't necessarily need to upgrade. I know there's been some discussion about that, whether you should or shouldn't, and I'm not necessarily going to tell you what you should or shouldn't do in that case, but if you're working as an assistant editor and need to change your designation, the one thing I found is I put my paperwork in, and because I hadn't worked for a long time, partially due to the strikes, some of my paperwork was outdated, and so it goes back to when you initially qualify for contract services as an assistant editor. I'm sure you remember, I think the requirement was 175 days of signatory or non-signatory work, but it was all dependent on getting letterhead from the payroll company, and you had to be paid as an assistant editor. And so in doing this, when I went into it, I got a little cocky going, oh, I've been a VFX editor for years, this will be a snap. And I found in my case, it actually wasn't. I have all my pay stubs going back to 2010. So I'm like, I'm just going to send them all my pay stubs and it'll be fine. And I was told, no, I needed to contact the payroll companies and get a letterhead and say, I need to know my dates of work from this date to that day. And it even got a little bit more complicated because, as most VFX editors might know, sometimes you are credited as an assistant editor, sometimes you're credited as an editor. And in the situations where you're credited as an assistant editor, because I was on one of my projects, I got the letterhead sent to contract services, and they said, you need to get us a credit list or something that actually specifically calls you a VFX editor. And I found that it threw another kind of monkey wrench in the operation. It's like, okay, well, I tried explaining to them, well, we're normally called assistant editors. That's kind of been the problem. That's why we got the designation. And they said, right. Well, we need some way of knowing that. And I eventually contacted the studio of my last project and I said, can I get a copy of the credit list? I sent that off and then my days got qualified. But it is something I would urge anybody who has been out of work for a time, and if you're still out of work, if you haven't changed your paperwork, if you haven't contacted contract services to get your designation changed officially, you should jump on that because some of your days might now be out of date depending on how long it's been since you last worked. So, and I would hate for anybody to be prepared to go back to work and to have a situation where they say, if you want to take this job, we need you to be designated as a VFX editor, and you don't have that done. So I would urge everybody to go to contract services, get that done as soon as you can. Because the other thing I had to do was I had to take an additional harassment class. As an assistant editor, I had to take harassment 1, and as a VFX editor, I had to take harassment 2. It's a harassment class from the perspective of being a leader versus being on the floor. And so again, for anybody who might be in a situation down the line where they have a job coming up, but that becomes a contingency, I would again urge everyone, get this done sooner rather than later.
That's www.csatf.org for contract services. We can put more information in our notes on this episode.
And I will give a lot of credit to contract services. If you need to give them a call, because I was on the phone with them it took me about 5 business days, back and forth. Hey, does this work? Does this work? But I will give them a lot of credit. They were very friendly and very helpful. I just had to go back and forth more than I wanted to, but there are folks there that will help you.
Yeah, I'm under the Z1 editor contract.
Okay.
So I don't know if that's... Does that something that do I classify under anything that I need to update?
That's quite honestly a question that I can't necessarily answer. So, because it might... The question then is, you're currently working as a Z1, but are you designated as a Z1? And so that might be a question, one for the guild, or for contract services.
Okay. So I feel like I'm designated as a VFX editor.
Unless you've changed your paperwork recently, you're not designated as a VFX editor because there wasn't a designation as a VFX editor.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
Right.
So your credit on the show as a VFX editor, the job you've been doing for years as a VFX editor, but there was no designation within the Motion Picture Editors Guild, nor was there a designation within contract services as a VFX editor. And that is new and something that's changed with this contract.
Got it. Yeah. So I'll have to do that as well.
Yeah.
So, yeah, let's all do that together. Yeah. VFX editors out there, if you haven't done it yet. Yeah, I know, because I know when you're talking about your story getting into the union, you know, I joined on the East Coast.
Mm-hmm.
It was a whole different situation.
Yeah.
Not as many members out there. So yeah. It's basically, are you being hired by a union member? And do they vouch for you? Yeah. If yes, then you can pay your dues and join.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
So it is interesting out here that it's, I mean, there's a lot more competition. There's more people.
Sure.
There's more work. So it makes sense. There's a little more to it. But one of the other things we want to talk about was there was a YouTube video that was cycling through that was about, I think it was called God Mode Hard or yes, something like that.
I do remember that.
It was the idea that somebody was attempting to learn Avid Media Composer in 3 days. And the video was about their struggle to learn it, and they seem to be maybe a Premiere user.
Yeah, within the description of the YouTube channel, they were selling Premiere, so a lot of people were mentioning, follow the money, where is this getting at?
Yeah.
There's an ulterior motive.
But what we saw on this post were the number of people in the comments that were agreeing with the hate on Avid. And it was really interesting because this was like an Avid Media Composer message board on Facebook, wasn't mm-hmm. it? And I found it fascinating that so many people are like, oh, Avid sucks, or why does it have to be so hard and complicated? And why aren't we using, you know, maybe whatever other program, DaVinci, Premiere,
yeah,
CapCut, maybe the kids will say.
Yeah.
It is a, you know, the things are changing for sure. But
yeah,
professionally, you know, Avid is still the professional tool for editors out there. And I found it really funny because I watched the whole video and I'm thinking to myself, are you actually trying to learn this program? Or are you just making a video about how hard it is to learn a program in 3 days sitting on your couch on your laptop?
Well, and also, I think another important aspect of this also needs to be stated, too, is if you thought you were going to learn Avid in 3 days, that's not going to happen. But also, let's just say that if you're learning another editing system that is more intuitive, there might be systems that just make a little bit more sense and you can pick up and run with them. And that's fine, but if you think you're going to learn any piece of software, doesn't matter what it is, in 3 days, you might understand it and can run with it from the get-go quicker, but you're not going to become an expert in 3 days. So it's an unrealistic concept. And I understand that it was made partially as a joke, but it also kind of turned into a communal feeding frenzy.
It really did.
Yeah.
And I was just kind of sitting there with my popcorn reading the comments because it's just surprising to me. And it's not that surprising. I mean, there are a lot of people who maybe are, you're not working in Avid. Maybe you're working more in Premiere. Certainly shows work in Premiere. Not every single show out there is working in Avid. And perhaps you have been on something that has yet to be an Avid show. And then you had to jump over to it. And it's very difficult. It was mm-hmm. difficult for me when I first started. But the thing is, it's like any program. Any program's a little difficult if you know nothing about it.
Yes.
So I just found it really simplistic to say in a video that it's really for the entertainment value and clicks and likes, to say, oh, it's so hard. Why does it be so hard? I'm like, well, yeah, just go look up, read a tutorial.
Yeah.
Like freshen up your skills and maybe try to learn something without trying to make a video about how hard it is to learn.
Yeah. I would say like my salty response to something like that is everything is hard before you learn how to do it. But now let me not be bad cop for a second and just say, like, look, I mean, yes, it's going to take time. It's going to take a lot of dedication. And also, learning on your own is one thing, but learning with professionals who have good working habits based on working on other shows is also something different, too. Now, I'm not going to look at Avid with rose-colored glasses. You've worked on it for a long time. I've worked on it for a long time. Avid has its faults. Of course it does. All programs have their faults. But, you know, I do find another thing, too, is when people start jumping on it, especially in a professional group like that, a group dedicated to helping people and giving people advice, when people take pleasure, especially knowing that there are customer representatives for Avid, a lot of really nice ones. We love you, Mariana Montague. Love you to death. Really nice people who are constantly helping the community, I get a little annoyed. And I also find that when people are complaining about things that are maybe take more steps to get done, but I go, you're complaining about things where there are very simple solutions to your problem. At a certain point, I go, I don't think that's an AVID problem. I think that's a you problem, and you can learn these things, and people like myself and others are happy to help you, but I find it's very off-putting that if you're going to just badmouth this thing without really giving it a fair shake, first of all, I become uninterested in helping, and two, I just go, I'm just seeing you kind of look bad in a form of professionals,
and not to sound like cliche, like what your grandma probably taught you, but like if you don't have something nice to say, don't say anything at all. You know, that's part of what that is.
But there's truth to that. But
that's not what the internet's about. Internet's not about that.
I will, but there's also truth to the squeaky wheel gets the oil.
Fair.
And I do think there's something to be said of in professional groups. You can point things out. You can point things out to the engineers and say, hey, this thing is kind of problematic. Hey, is there a way to fix it? And one, you might find there is a way to fix it. There's a feature you didn't even know about. And you go, oh, cool. That's amazing.
And how often are we all learning a new trick in AVID that we've been using the program for decades? And we just like, I never knew I could do this. 100%.
All the time. And the other thing, or you get people, again, like Mariana Montague, who is super receptive, writes these things down. Hey, I'll pass that on to the engineers. And maybe you won't get a solution to it for a while. It might even take years. But people listen and they make changes. And I feel like, just like we as editors want our clients to be reasonable with us and not ask us to do, you know, 40 hours worth of work in one day, you know, it's like, okay, I need people to be reasonable with what they expect from me. We need to be also reasonable with what we expect from AVID.
Yeah. And for context of the video that we're speaking of, part of the expectations of the creator of the video was that he would write, shoot, direct, edit, do visual effects, music, and like basically every aspect of his little short film in AVID, and expecting it to be Interstellar. Like expecting such ease of use without really understanding all of post-production in Hollywood film. And I understand that, because if you don't work in it, you don't really know the process. But the expectation was that this is the elite editing software from all the professionals. Well, yes, but there's more to it. You know, there's more that goes into it. Yeah. And I know for someone who was, we both, doing visual effects editing, yes, you can do a lot of visual effect work in AVID, but it is a little rudimentary. There's only so much you can do before you have to take it out and go into After Effects or another program.
Or something,
Right. It's so much bigger. Is it also about how much, what do you expect going into learning a new program? What do you want to get out of it? So it would be nice to see, a more lengthy commentary of, I tried this program and it took me 6 months and this is my doc, this is my, you know, adventure into it. And this is how I really learned it and understood it. And now I'm teaching you.
Yeah.
Versus, why is it so hard?
Yeah.
You know, this doesn't work the same way Premiere does. Well, no, it doesn't. It's different. This is for professional use, for multiple users sharing a project, which if you're in Premiere, like I use Premiere for my personal projects. Mm-hmm. Why? Because it's a lot faster. Mm-hmm. In terms of just loading up some clips and just cutting and getting it out just for personal use. Yeah. You know, I don't need the robustness of AVID.
But for the same reason, someone like you and I, if you are tasked with delivering a feature, I'm sure there are features that are likely in the software, but you don't know about or would go about differently. That, again, if we go into a group and say, again, why the NLE wars are so obnoxious is this software stinks. And it's like, no, you just don't know where that button is. That feature is there. Or maybe there's a feature you haven't even thought of that, oh, you can do that? That's so cool. Mm-hmm. And
Yeah, and there's a different level of editing for content creation.
You use the word.
Know. I hate it. There's a different level of, you know, editing software for people who are doing YouTube videos and things like that, or TikTok videos. that are designed for ease of use.
Yeah.
It's designed so it's like a couple clicks on a touch screen, you know, on your cell phone, you can edit these videos.
Yeah, with CapCut.
That's very different than a robust program for multiple users with multiple levels of complexity in your film. So I just hope people are looking at that, and rather than taking away the Avid sucks, take away, hey, why did this guy make a video where he only gave himself 3 days to learn a program and then really just made it to make a video?
Yeah.
The point of this is to make a video, not really to say I'm really investing myself in learning a new program.
But also,
it's a very different thing.
One thing I would just offer too is, again, like, nobody knows everything. I don't know everything. But if you're in the position that makes you upset at a piece of software like that, you know, it makes you angry because it isn't as easy as it seems, you'll probably get a better result from the community by being fair and saying, I don't know how to get this done. This is annoying me, rather than posting a video and saying the software sucks. That doesn't make people want to help. And right, so I would just offer. But you know what I will say on the note of Avid and software, they just released a new version, I believe this week.
Oh, really?
2024.12.
There you go.
And I've been testing it out. Tremendous update, because it's the first version that is native Apple Silicon, which is a huge deal. People have been asking for this for years. I know a lot of other software manufacturers have done it much faster. Avid finally brought it to the table, and it's awesome. Another cool thing, I can see Steve on his laptop looking at the new features.
Yeah.
There are source monitor waveforms. I know.
Finally.
Yes, finally. Okay, yes, I started in Final Cut Pro.
Yeah.
I used to love that. But, you know, at this point, I've also gotten used to toggle
timeline. You can toggle your timeline. That's the same thing.
Yeah.
It's weird to see the visual. There. It's a weird thing, because really your composer monitor and your source monitor are monitors.
Yeah.
They aren't for the audio. It's for picture.
Yeah.
So it makes sense that you wouldn't see anything.
Yep.
But when you're jumping between different editing programs, and the other editing programs show you the waveforms and Avid doesn't, then it's like, not that they should all be equal, but some things you get used to.
Yeah, very much so.
So this might be a nice thing to be able to just visually see.
It's nice.
Because when I am cutting in Premiere, it is nice to quickly see in my source view my audio file.
And is it clipping or is it...
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And in addition to Apple native Silicon, there's a new version of Blackmagic Desktop Video if you're using a breakout box. In my case, I use an Avid DNX ID, and they have a new version of that software that works in tandem with it. And it is smooth as butter. And
nice.
I will say too, as much as nobody likes Tidaler Plus, it was really smooth. I've just been playing with it, and it's smoother than I've ever seen that tool work.
What version of Avid are you working with?
This is the new 2024.
Oh, so the new one.
Yeah.
And your current one, I'm on 2023.12 or something, maybe. And I can't even get Tidaler to even open.
Okay. You know,
some bug we have, and I don't need to use titles anyway, but like I was trying to do something once, and I'm like, why doesn't even open up?
Yeah, you know, it's there. If you go to any Facebook group about Avid, you will hear people complain about Tidaler Plus ad nauseum. I will say, on my last project, in that case we were using 2022, I made a concerted effort to use Tidaler, and like I would motion track titles into visual effects, and it can be done, but I did find that there was a lot of challenges with it, and I found that I would have to treat titles more like a visual effect, where I would save it in a bin and version it every time so that if something got screwy, I could go back to an old version. Now, yes, something as basic as titles, I would wish that I wouldn't have to do that, but I found for me that worked. So that's something to keep in mind. Another thing to keep in mind with the new version of Avid, the new 2024.12, is if you use Sync by Waveform, that function does not work native Apple Silicon. But if you power up the software in Rosetta mode, which you can do by right-clicking on the application, then you can run that. So that's one thing. I know some people were upset about that. But
what's Rosetta mode?
So Rosetta mode is, it basically runs in a way that emulates Intel chips. And so if you're using plugins that are not compatible with Apple Silicon, like the really popular MDV plugin, which allows you to use blend modes in Avid, I know there's not an Apple Silicon version of that. So as of now, you can just load Avid up in Rosetta mode, and that'll get you running.
Nice.
And the other thing that Avid has, they're continuing to work on is OTIO, which I don't know. I'm not familiar with that. So OTIO stands for Open Timeline IO. And it's a format that's really been pioneered by visual effects artists. And the idea is that it's a more robust, more modern version of effectively the EDL. And I think the long-term game plan is that instead of kicking out an EDL to a visual effects house, you could kick out an OTIO, and it's more metadata rich. So for example, it'll keep track of things like if you have a blow up on a shot, if you have, you know, repositions and stuff, it'll track that more easily. It's interesting. I still think it's in its early stages. The one thing I noticed is testing with it, kicking out an EDL, you know, you go into the list tool, you drag your sequence, and it just, in a matter of seconds, there's your EDL. I found with OTIO, it takes quite a while because there's so much metadata. I'm sure over time that'll get refined and it'll get faster. Yeah. But
are you using 2024 0.12? Mm-hmm. Is that what it is? Are you using that in your current project, or is this something you've downloaded for yourself?
I've downloaded it for myself. Okay. On my current project, I'm using 2022.
Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. And with the my work around the titles has always been using the subcap effect, which has never done me wrong.
Subcap effect is?
It's basically the same thing. Mm-hmm. It's just you can't alter the text quite as much.
That is true.
But that's always a workaround.
Yeah.
That might be about it for our show. Thanks for listening. And we just want to thank everybody who is listening, whether on Apple Podcast or Spotify, however you get your podcasts, or if you're listening to us on YouTube, on our YouTube page, which is the Render Bar Podcast. Please rate and review our episodes that you hear. We'd love to get your feedback and see what you guys like, what you don't like, what you're hopefully not too much what you're annoyed by.
Yeah.
But give us only positive feedback. Only positive yes. feedback. We will delete all negative feedback. No, kidding.
No, we'll take feedback. We can take it.
Yeah, and you can also we'd love to hear from you. Reach out to us at renderbarpod@gmail.com. And if you want to find me, I'm on have a website, it's www.stevejacks.com. And Richard, is there any way people can reach out to you if they need to?
Renderbarpod@gmail. Reach me at the email and you'll reach us there. But if nothing else, before we leave you, just 2025 has been a rough year, as has the prior. Be good to yourself. Be kind to yourself. This will change. Reach out to your friends. Take care of your mental health. You're not alone. We're with you.
Love it. All right, guys. Take it easy.
If you have a question or a topic that you'd like to hear us discuss on the Render Bar, feel free to reach out to us at our email at renderbarpod@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.